Studio 360.
Much have I traveled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which barge in fealty to Apollo hold. That is the one poem I know by heart. It's only 14 lines, a sonnet, on first looking into Chapman's Homer by John Keats from 200 years ago, about his reading a translation from 200 years before that of poetry from a couple of 3,000 years before that, the Iliad and the Odyssey. Today on Studio 360, we are celebrating poetry, great American poetry. The limelight that American culture gives to poets these days is fairly limited, so winning the National Book Award for poetry is a big deal, as is being named a MacArthur Genius. Terrence Hayes has done both of those, and in 2014, he was also named one of People magazine's Sexiest Men Alive. So, the Triple Crown. When I spoke with him in 2015, I asked which of those awards was most surprising to him.
I don't know. Which was the most embarrassing? I can answer that.
I bet
that
I know
question.
The answer to that.
I guess I would say in a really general way, art is not the kind of thing where you get what you put into it all the time. So I learned to not expect anything other than the sort of joy of having a poem
right.
in front of me.
Right. You grew up in South Carolina in the 1970s and 80s, and I've read that you said that race, when you were growing up there, did not seem like much of an issue at all. And you went to a school that was mostly white kids. Why was race not an issue?
Well, I mean, if I frame it in terms of saying that I was a basketball player and I won't say track star, but I ran track.
Right.
And I was a visual artist, so the sort of anonymous black kid, I think, would have had a completely different experience uh-huh. than I did. But I was sheltered. I mean, I was a good student as well. And so there were just ways that people knew where to put me, whether they were going to put me in, oh, there's Terrence, he's the basketball player, or there's Terrence, he did the school T-shirts and the school mascots. So ironically, it was only when I came north, and I was sure that coming north, you know, it didn't even occur to me that there would be issues, but I got north and I certainly realized suddenly that I wasn't a student and that when people saw me on the street, they had other kinds of ideas about me. And so I think there's a poem in my first book called Shaft and the Enchanted Shoe Factory, which mm-hmm. is just really about an experience I had going to buy a pair of shoes and just sort of having a really strange time with the shoe salesman, which I now understand to have been a kind of like racial tension. But at the time, I was just constantly trying to figure out what was going on. I thought it was the weather. Like, is it just the snow? People are upset because of the weather. But, you know, I came to understand what it was.
One of the poems in the new book called Portrait of Etheridge Knight in the Style of a Crime Report is about the late poet Etheridge Knight, who was a junkie and a robber and a convict mm-hmm. before he became a poet. And he's best known for his book called Poems from Prison. I'm wondering, what drew you to Knight and when?
The first poet I met when I was in college, it so happened, was a really good friend of Etheridge Knight's, this poet named Fran Quinn, who still lives in Indianapolis. And so no one knew I wrote. I was a basketball player. I was majoring in fine arts and actually taking chorus at the time, but I stopped that pretty quickly.
Chorus?
But yeah, so no one knew about that especially. So my teacher put us in his office. We met, we talked. He asked me what poems I liked. And I did like Etheridge Knight because, you know, both my parents were prison guards. And so when I read his poems, I was instantly intrigued in his subject matter. And so Fran said to me then, would you like to meet Etheridge Knight? And he invited me to Indianapolis over Christmas break. And I said, yeah. And then when the time came, I sort of backed out because I thought, my parents aren't going to let me go see an ex-con. I don't even know this white man who is inviting me. And then I had a basketball tournament. And so I didn't go. I had his number. I said maybe over the summer. And then Etheridge died in March. So I never got to meet him. You know, he's sort of been a ghost, you know, the right. almost relationship. But the poems are also, you know, quite impressive. And in fact, every other book, I only realized this with this book, every other book has an Etheridge Knight poem in it. So my first book did had a poem riffing on one of his popular poems, As You Leave Me. And then my third book, Wind in a Box, has a poem called The Blue Etheridge. And now this book also has a poem. So that wasn't deliberate, but he's always, you know, on my mind.
Another great African-American writer who's obviously on your mind is Ralph Ellison. He's the subject of one of my favorite poems in this book. It's called How to Draw an Invisible Man. Would you read it for us?
Sure. So this one is, it's Ralph Ellison, and the scenario is just what would happen if you were Ralph Ellison's mortician or coroner, I guess. And then, when Ralph Ellison's corpse burst open, I discovered his body had been hoarding all these years a luscious slush, a sludge of arterial words, the raw and unsaid pages with their plots and propositions, with their arcs of intention and babbling, with their mumbling streams and false starts and their love and misanthropic thrust, tendons of syntax unraveled from his bones and intestinal cavities, the froth of singing, stinging, stinking ink, reams of script fraught with the demons, demagogues, and demigods of democracy, demographies of vague landscapes, passages describing muddy river bottoms and elaborate protagonists crawling through a foliage greener than money in America before America thought to release anyone from its dream. The waterlogged monologues one who is unseen speaks burst suddenly from Ralph Ellison's body. And because I mean to live transparently, I am here, bear with me, describing the contents, the fictions envisioned by Emerson and immigrants, the dogmas, aboriginal progeny, scholastic recriminations, dementia, jubilee, hubris in Ralph Ellison, Duke Ellington's shadow, a paragraph on the feathered headdress of Marcus Garvey. Some of it was pornography. Some of it alluded to Negroes who believe educating black kids means teaching them to help white people feel comfortable. Some of it outlined the perks of invisibility, how we are obliged to eschew the zoo, the farm animals. It had something to do with captivity, flayed in the clinical light. The notes printed on the underside of his flesh were reversed, but readable, mirrored in the metal of the medical table. And I wanted to print it all properly in a posthumous book in the name of prosperity and proof the genius we believed he'd wasted had been waiting all these years for a simple death sentence to break free.
That's Terrence Hayes reading his poem, How to Draw an Invisible Man. Invisible Man, of course, the novel by Ralph Ellison, was taught to me when I was in school as the great African-American novel. I'm wondering if you feel at all, being a black American man growing up when you did, if you are in any sense invisible.
Well, you know, this is in the poem. And, you know, the great thing about being a poet, obviously, is that many of these questions, you know, if I've had these questions, they've shown up in the poems. So the thing that I've decided is that I don't want to be invisible, but I'd like to be transparent. And so that means I want people to sort of see what I'm thinking and see through me, but I don't want to be invisible. And so that's sort of a play on words, but it certainly is how I sort of live my life. And it's how I come to terms with the notion of invisibility. I'm not threatened by it. I'm not concerned by it. I don't think I ever was, really. You know, I'm about 6'6". So, you know, I don't have trouble walking into a room. And
yeah.
I would prefer to be more invisible, in fact, than I am.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that kind of problem.
Right. A lot of your poems are musical, not just in the way the words sound, but also you reference music and musicians a lot. In the new book, there's a poem that quotes the song His Pain, which is the song we're hearing now by BJ the Chicago Kid featuring Kendrick Lamar.
Turned around and found $100. I don't know why he keep blessing me. 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 I don't know why. I don't know why.
I'm wondering if you would read a little bit of your poem, The Carpenter Ant, which quotes from that song.
Sure. Let's see. It was when or because she became two kinds of mad, both a feral nail biting into a plank and a deranged screw cranking into a wood beam, the aunt, I shouldn't say her name, went at the fullest hour of the night, the moon there like an unflowered bulb in a darkness like mud, or covered in darkness as a bulb or skull is covered in mud. The small brown aunt who, before she went mad, taught herself to carpenter and unhinged in her madness the walls she claimed were bugged with tiny red-eyed devices planted by the state or Satan's agents, ghosts of atheists, her foes, or worse, the walls were full of the bugs she believed crawled from her former son-in-law's crooked mouth, the aunt, who knows, as all creatures know, you have to be rooted in something tangible as wood if you wish to dream in peace, took her hammer with its claw like a mandible to her own handmade housing, humming, I don't know why God keeps blessing me, softly, madly, and I understood. I was with her when the pallbearers carried a box made of mahogany from her church to a hearse to a hole in the earth. It made me think of the carpenter ant who carries within its blood an evolved self-destructive property and on its face mandibles twice the size of its body and can carry on its back, as I have seen on TV, a rotted bird or branch great distances to wherever the queen is buried. Kingdom Animalia, Phylum Arthropoda, Tribe Camponotini, the species that lives on wood is, like mud, rain, and time, the carpenter's enemy. Yes, but I would love to devour the house I live in until it is a permanent part of me. I would love to shape as Perumthachan, the master sculptor, carpenter, and architect of India, is said to have shaped, a beautiful tree into the coffin in which I am to be buried. I know whatever we place in a coffin, the coffin remains empty. I know nothing buried is buried. I don't know why God keeps blessing me. I don't know why God keeps blessing me.
So from Kendrick Lamar to Ralph Ellison to Marcus Garvey, and there's Sylvia Plath elsewhere, you have a very wide radius of influence.
Sure. I mean, the parallel would be music. When I think about the, you know, between Monk and Chopin and Jimi Hendrix and
I like those. I like all of those guys.
Sure, sure. And Matt Most, you know, we can go electronic music, Burial. I think music is a great sort of marker for me in terms of breadth, in terms of reading as broadly and being as generous with poems and other poets as I am with music.
It has been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, thanks. It was a joy.
Terrence Hayes' How to Be Drawn is available everywhere, and his new book, American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin, comes out in June.